Welcome, everybody, to the May 13th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. Oh, let's see here. We're going to start out with, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3401. James, go for it.
House Bill 3401A directs the Department of Transportation to study options for improving the on-time performance of passenger trains and to study options for optimizing ridership on passenger trains. Directs Department to develop passenger rail plan to increase ridership and ticket revenue. Requires Department to submit quarterly reports to interim legislative committees on transportation and a final report to legislative assembly by November 30th, 2015. Sunsets January 2nd, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments, there's no revenue impact, and has a minimal fiscal impact.
Representative Nathanson. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. Oregon's passenger trains are sometimes late on arrival. There is no faster way to lose customers from passenger rail service than to make riders wait on the platform or arrive home or at a meeting late. ODOT cites a drop in on-time performance as one of the key contributing factors to a drop in Amtrak ridership in 2014 after many years of consistent and large increases, including a 255% increase in ridership between 1995 and 2013. In order to ensure that Oregon's passenger rail has sustainable ridership in the future, we must improve the on-time performance of our trains. While a long-time goal of Oregon passenger rail is improving the speed, and some of the recent investments do shorten travel time, the critical aspect that needs to be addressed today is ensuring that trains arrive at the time that they're scheduled. Passengers care about speed, for sure, but they care even more about options and reliability. On-time performance of passenger and freight rail has been volatile. In the 2014 fiscal year, on-time performance, which is defined as arriving within 10 minutes of the scheduled time, was under 90%. During four of those weeks in 2014, one in five trains arrived more than 10 minutes late. For many Amtrak riders, on-time performance is vital to their travel. 12% of riders are commuting to work or to school, and an additional 12% are traveling for other business reasons. This means that a quarter of the riders are expecting to be somewhere on time, and they need to be. Other riders are relying sometimes on trains that are scheduled to make connections with local travel modes. Here's one example of what happens when problems occur, when extreme weather, limited track, and other equipment and infrastructure problems coalesce and turn out to result in poor transit time for passengers and freight. Last year, under a very unusual weather situation, very unfortunate conditions in the winter, a manufacturer north of Albany warned that its manufacturing plant would have to shut down within 2 days because it hadn't received its supply of materials that were waiting on track. While the Omaha, Nebraska dispatcher found a way to get the trains moving and release the stranded freight train to deliver the materials to the manufacturer to keep the manufacturer open and to keep those jobs running, it meant another 1 hour and 22 minute delay for a passenger train. This bill directs ODOT to study ways to improve the on-time performance of passenger trains and to study operational changes that can improve the on-time performance and ridership, including schedule changes, marketing, partnering with other agencies, and boosting tourism. It also directs ODOT to look into infrastructure improvements. Those could include, for example, things like parallel tracks, longer sidings, separated grade crossings, maybe switching systems at convergence points. Union Pacific Railroad participated in developing the language in this bill and looks forward to continuing their work to make passenger rail successful in Oregon. Identifying the changes that need to take place in order to improve passenger rail is an essential step to improving the experience for our train passengers and meeting our overall transportation goals. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Questions?
Oh, I was just listening. First, I was going to say we'll leave sooner and drive faster, but you already covered that. And I didn't realize that. You know, my question was, well, why is it? But you mentioned things like they'd have to stop to let some other train that had a priority go, and that leads to that
yes.
kind of an issue. So I'll be in favor of this.
Thank you.
The next couple, maybe not.
Yeah, I'm kind of still a little bit nervous about the why question, because this is, again, as a study, and studies don't necessarily get you to where you want to go. And one idea would be Amtrak is subsidized very heavily. Tie the subsidies to the rate of arrival. Or why do you think that the Department of Transportation isn't looking into this to start with? I'm just trying to justify the expenditure of a study. That's it.
Well, we do have comments coming from ODOT and another gentleman from...
Yeah, okay. I understand the problem.
I don't know if you want to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will make a very short statement because, as you point out, some other testimony will be coming. It's not simply a study. I think that there will be some operational changes that will be proposed. For example, schedule changes that riders have been asking for. There were some changes to the schedule made about a year, a little more than a year ago. Some of those haven't materialized in increasing ridership. They may have contributed to some decrease for a period of time, so they're going to be looking at change that they can actually implement. It's different than a study where we might need to then where you study something and then 2 years later something else may happen. ODOT will be able to start to implement some changes. It's also a really good thing to have plans in place when the federal government makes money available. For example, if money should come available for infrastructure improvements, if we already know where we need to improve a crossing or have some help with switching equipment or other infrastructure changes, we will have some plans in place and can move much more quickly. And on the issue of incentives for on-time performance, there is a disincentive. There are penalties, and I believe that ODOT can speak to what those penalties are.
Good. Senator Monroe?
Yeah, we've been dealing with this issue in the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation, which I sit on, and there's strong support on the Ways and Means Subcommittee for changing the scheduling so as to attract more riders. So this is an issue that has been before that committee a couple of times as well.
Okay. Anything else before we let the representative go? Anything else, Representative?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll let you go back to work, and we will recess on this for the moment, and we will open on who is next?
Representative Wilson. So
okay.
3005.
House, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3005. James, Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3005 extends the expiration date of a driver's license for persons volunteering outside the United States, specifies that driver's license expires 90 days following the individual return to the United States. There are no amendments, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay. Welcome, Representative.
Chair Blair, Vice Chair Girod. Thank you for hearing the bill. Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass. I brought this forward due to a request of a friend of mine, a guy I graduated from high school with, who's been a missionary ever since that time in Africa. And frequently in his life, upon returning to Portland after extended tours in Africa, he has found that his driver's license has been expired. Some of us wouldn't worry too much about that, but he, being a man of the cloth, is very concerned about that. And so he asked me if we could do something that would include folks like him in a bill like this that would give him some protection as he flies back into Portland, drives back to Grants Pass, just to make sure that he is in good shape there. So not the signature bill of the session, but, you know, come to think of it, for me, it might be. So.
I've been there and done that.
Thank you for hearing my
Senator Thompson?
Yeah, Wilson, I've read, I saw something in the Oregonian or some read somewhere where there were vets or serving military people that had the same problem.
Yes.
But this bill doesn't seem to target our military at all. Would a military person that has been overseas and their license expires, would they fall into this too?
Senator Beyer and Senator Thompson, the military is already included in this kind of situation, I understand. So they're already already enjoying the benefits of this bill. Okay. These folks just simply join that group of folks.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Right. Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3005? Seeing none, we will close public hearing, open a work session. Chair moves House Bill 3005. Is there an A? No A. To the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? No discussion. Is there any opposition? It's done. House Bill 3005 is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. You want to carry?
Sure. It'll probably be the best bill I get to carry this session, too.
Senator Thompson will carry. We'll close on that. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3255A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3255A replaces requirement for rear reflector or a light device when operating a bicycle during limited visibility conditions, a requirement of red light on rear of bicycle. There are no amendments, no revenue impact, and it has a minimal fiscal impact.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee, honorable members of the committee. It's a great pleasure to be before you today.
Were you differentiating between some of us?
To talk to you about the greatest nanny state bill this session. Uh-huh. This bill would do a very simple thing, which it would now require cyclists, when they're riding on a state highway or a highway, a public road, I think the definition under the statute of highway does include public roads, at night, to not simply have a rear reflector, but to also have a red light on the cycle, on the bike, just as all our vehicles do and many other things, most other things, that are on our roads. I'll remind you that cyclists, bicyclists are allowed to use sidewalks at night and at all other times as well under Oregon law. So there's been some concern about this bill not allowing kids to get home from school if they don't have a red light. Well, there are often sidewalks. I'd like to point you to some of the testimony in OLIS. There's a couple studies that I've uploaded. One is a study that demonstrates that people are not as visible on bikes at night as they think they are. We all have a perception that we're more visible either in our cars or in our bikes at night than we actually are. There's a study that demonstrates that. And there's also the most recent statistics I could find from the NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And if you look on page 2 of that upload, that fact sheet, it shows you the time of day for the percentage of cyclist fatalities. And it clearly demonstrates that the vast majority of fatalities for cyclists occurs at night. And I would submit to you that these two studies that I've just discussed are closely tied, that we think we're more visible at night when we're riding our bikes on public roads, and therefore there are more accidents at night, and there's more cyclists killed. And I'm sure that we all have stories of coming up closely on a cyclist or riding at night and having close calls. And that's the intent of this bill, is to require cyclists to have a light, a rear light, at night on public roads so that they can be more visible and we can have safer roads and also safer and happier drivers too, frankly. This bill comes to you from a number of my constituents who have expressed concern with the number of cyclists riding at night without proper lighting. And it also comes with a lot of support, frankly, from individual cyclists who I know who said, when they're out at night, we are lit up like Christmas trees, and they're really concerned with cyclists who are out there without proper lighting and who are riding in an unsafe manner. Thank you.
Okay. Questions of the representative? Yes. Senator Monroe.
On my bike, I not only have a rear light, but it flashes. And which is a real advantage for being seen. You know, when I drive and I see a bicyclist with a rear light that's flashing, draws your attention to it, so it's much better than just a single light. Also, rear light on a bicycle is way more important than a headlight, because problems are when cars are overtaking you from behind.
That's right.
So I will strongly support this bill.
Thank you, Senator. And through the chair, if I could also respond. There's another study I found, which I did not upload, which talks about reflectors on cyclists and says that moving reflectors or blinking reflectors or lights are the most effective.
Yeah.
But this bill would not require a blinker, just a red light. But that is the most effective way to be visible.
Other questions? You have a question?
Yeah, come on.
I read in the bill what happens if you don't have this light on? Your bill says Class C felony. Are you going to stay with a felony charge, or are you going to try to make it a little lower?
No, the bill simply amends the existing. Through the chair. Thank you, Chair and Senator. This bill simply amends existing requirements for bicycle equipment requirements. And that is a Class D violation.
Yeah.
So it's a ticket. Yeah. But I would strongly support any amendment that would make it a Class A felony.
Oh, yeah, right. I might have misread that.
We may have constitutional problems with that amendment.
You might.
So we may have constitutional problems. All right.
I might have another question.
Well, go ahead then.
So did your studies, I like the color blue better. Did any of your studies pick out blue, yellow? How did you get to red? And you don't have a company that sells these little red lights, do you, Rep. Davis?
Chair Beyer, I'd like to declare a conflict of interest. through the chair, Senator. Simply based on practice, current vehicle code requires rear red lights on vehicles, so I thought for the benefit of everybody driving on the roads, it'd be good to have some uniformity there. But I like many colors. Green's my favorite.
Okay. I think I'll stop now.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who has legitimate questions that are presented? Thank you, Representative.
Thank
you,
we'll
let you go back to work. All right. We will recess on that, and we will open on, let's see, who we got here, on House Bill 3487.
Excuse me.
We'll get back to it.
Oh, okay.
Representative Huffman, for those who don't, the benefit, the courtesy is we usually try to get the other members of the legislature in and out as quickly as we can so they can go back to work.
You want us to be productive?
That would be nice.
We're always productive in this committee.
Thank you, Chair Representative. John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59. There are going to be a couple of gentlemen testifying on House Bill 3487 to provide more testimony, but the bottom line on this is I brought the bill forward at the request of probably most of the board for the private investigators that are under the purview of DPSST, and the board used to be under a separate entity, but apparently back in about 2005, when the board was moved into DPSST, or under DPSST, Eric's will correct what I say that I say wrong. He'll correct that when he comes up. But in the statute to transfer the board to DPSST, somehow inadvertently, a little detail was dropped out of the statute that would require a private investigator to list their name and license number in any advertisement. And so it's a pretty simple bill just to get that back in the statute. It makes the private investigator community feel better and safer, and so that's why we have the bill here. And I would like to point out, unlike Representative that was here before me, Mr. Davis, I have treated each of you honorably today. I'm pretty sure I voted
Notice
for
that.
All of your bills on the House floor this morning, so I'm happy to answer questions.
Representative? Yeah. Anybody have questions as a representative?
Is anybody to
you
testify?
You got up easy.
Yeah,
yes, we
have
got
two.
A couple of others. We'll just go ahead and take care of it.
We have the real experts to testify after.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
I don't see another legislator in the room, so we'll go ahead with this one then. Jim Gibson and Eric
Gablins.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Wasn't sure if those were L's or I's.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Gibson, Honorable Chair and Committee. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3487 that amends ORS 703450 and puts back the requirement for licensed investigators to put their name and license number on their advertising. This information is critical for the public when they are trying to hire somebody, to know that they're getting somebody that's licensed, insured, and or bonded. DPSST maintains the database for the investigators, and ironically, it's searchable by name and license number. So if you don't have those pieces, it's pretty hard to look up that person to see if they're truly licensed. We don't know how it got dropped out of statute when that transition took place, but we think it's really important to get it back in the statute. Majority of the licensed investigators that I've talked with, and I've previously served as a membership director and past president of the Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators, there's currently over 660 licensed investigators in the state of Oregon that this would apply to. It's a very minor change for us. We put it in our letterhead. I already have it on everything. I always have. I came from a law enforcement background, 27 years paid and 3 years as a reserve. I'm also involved in public boards. I'm on our fire board and our library board locally. So I care about our communities and I care about our citizens. This piece, I believe, is a critical piece that protects the public and gets that assurance that these people are legitimate and not out there. Craigslist is the ultimate source for these rogue investigators that are trying to do business in the state of Oregon. So I would strongly urge you to support the passage of this bill and get it back into the statute to protect our citizens. That's the key piece. And I appreciate your time, and I appreciate Representative Huffman taking this bill at the request of Phil Agru, who is one of my constituents that actually requested that we get this back in the law. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Eric Skablix, I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known as DPSST. As many of you know, DPSST serves 41,000 public and private safety professionals in the state, police officers, corrections officers, firefighters, and more than 600 private investigators. As Representative Huffman said, during a transfer many years ago of what was called OBI, the Board of Investigators, to DPSST, a Scribner's oversight dropped this requirement out. The private security industry really sees this as a consumer protection issue, which is when they're looking to hire a private investigator, they want to make sure that they meet state standards, that they meet state's licensure. This is very easy for us to deal with from our enforcement end, basically policing the industry, and we're glad to support this issue in front of you today. And I'll keep my comments short, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? No questions? It was easy. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We'll open the work session. And the chair would move House Bill 3487 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. No discussion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Doesn't appear to be any. House Bill 3487 is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation, and Senator Gerard will carry. We'll close on that, and what else we got here? I don't see Representative Clem around, so we'll go back, and we will reopen on House Bill 3255, and Mr. Thomas?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name's Ray Thomas. I'm an attorney and a student of Oregon's bicycle and pedestrian laws, and I have spent my career educating thousands of Oregonians about their legal responsibilities as bicyclists and pedestrians in legal clinics that I've given around the state. I'm here to oppose this bill, not because it's not a safe and recommended practice to have as many lights as a person can have on their bicycle, because it is safer, but because this law is a bad idea when you consider that Oregon law has long held that bicyclists, in order to be compliant with the law, must have a rear red reflector or a rear red light. Either suffices. What this law would do is make every bicycle that's sold in the state of Oregon be illegal, because every bicycle in the state of Oregon is required by federal law to have a rear red reflector. Our law, if you read it carefully, requires that a rear red reflector be used to the rear in limited visibility conditions. That means that in late dusk, when a kid riding their bike in the neighborhood on a bike that is presently legal with a rear red reflector gets hit by a car from behind, if this law is in place, if that child doesn't have a rear red light on their bike, they are going to be blamed for being in violation of Oregon statutory law, which in court becomes statutory negligence. And I think that when you consider the fiscal on this, if this case or if this law was to pass, bear in mind that in Oregon, it's long been the law, and the majority law in the rest of the United States is that rear red reflectors are required to the rear. And our Oregon driver's manuals that go into school libraries, that go into public libraries, that are widely distributed to people, including the Oregon Bicyclist Manual, these are manuals that people take and keep. What this law would do is make these all contain an incorrect statement of the law, because each of these manuals tells folks that what you need is a rear red reflector to the rear. Think about what the public information campaign would be required to do to let all those people who have bicycles that they think are legal, that are now illegal to ride during limited visibility conditions. To think that this thing has a zero fiscal, I believe, is unrealistic. And also, think about the situation where somebody who doesn't know about this law is out at night, they've got their required front headlight on, and they're hit from the rear by a negligent driver. I'm a lawyer, and I've seen probably more bicycle collisions than any lawyer in the state of Oregon. I've been doing this since 1979. Frequently in a collision, the bike light gets knocked off and goes into the brush. If there's no light to the rear, then the officer is going to be required to note that there was no light. And we get placed into a very difficult proof situation. The situation that we have right now is that everybody who buys a bicycle has a bike that has a rear red reflector. And if you take a look at what a rear red reflector does, it's not folks who have rear red reflectors who are the folks on bikes that caused the person who wanted to have this law become the law to come forward and suggest it. It's the folks who are riding at night with dark clothes on, no lights at all. Those are the people who are the problem. And to make it so that people who are following the law and have bicycles that have the already legally required red lights or red reflectors, to make that illegal is going to make illegal all the bicycles that are out there. So I'd just like for you to consider the fact that it sounds, and it was described by Representative Davis as a nanny state law, and it sounds kind of benign. It's a good safety practice. Nobody would say that it's a bad idea to have a rear red light. And in my written testimony that I submitted, I suggested the analogy of the rear third brake light. All the cars since 1984 have been required by federal law to have a third rear brake light, always centered in the rear windshield or on the rear tailgate. It's a good idea. But when that improvement came, it didn't make it so that every car before 1984 that didn't have a rear red third brake light was illegal. And think about the cost that would be associated with the retrofit. I'm not saying that it's going to cost hundreds of dollars for everybody to put rear red lights on their bikes, But what I'm saying is that when you think about how what you're doing is requiring a new additional requirement for every single bike, we're not in a place in Oregon where we have the money to create a registration system for bicycles. We can't send an email to everybody in the state of Oregon who's got a registered bicycle and say, and oh, by the way, those bikes that you all have are now illegal. You got to go out and buy a light and put it on if you're going to have that bike legally ridden. And I'm not saying that it's not a good idea to have a rear red light. I look like a Christmas tree at night. The thing is that making a safe practice into a legally required minimum standard that makes every vehicle out there that comes out of a Fred Meyer store illegal is a bad idea. And for that reason, I oppose this law.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill doesn't require manufacturers or sellers of bicycles to put that light on before they sell it, does it?
No, it doesn't. And what the federal law is from the Consumer Product Safety Commission, it has long required that every bicycle that's sold have 8 reflectors. It's called the 8 reflector system, and it includes a rear red. And also it requires pedal reflectors and spoke reflectors and a front reflector. That 8 reflector system is required for every bicycle that is sold, and every dealer must sell a bicycle that has that system. So you've got folks who are going into maybe a bike store that would have the wherewithal to say to somebody, and oh, by the way, you need to buy a light. But what about if they buy the bike at a Walmart? Or what if they buy it at a big box store? The persons there who sell the bike are people who are working in the grocery department and every other department in the store. They're not going to say, and oh, by the way, you've got to have a light. And this law does not require either the manufacturers or the sellers to install a light that makes the bicycle legal. So I believe that it's just a logistical quagmire for us in Oregon. And the final thing I'd like to add is one of the things we're trying to do is to get bicycle tourists to come here. You all know from going on Highway 101 and many of our wine country roads, there's a whole lot of bicyclists who come here from other states. Well, I'll tell you that the vast majority of states only require a rear red reflector. It's based upon the Uniform Vehicle Code. So what you're going to do is you're going to have these people come here, and how are we going to let them all know, oh, that driver's manual that you pick up or what you're told about the law is no longer the law. What's the law in your state? A rear red reflector being adequate isn't adequate here. You've got to have a rear red light. I don't think that's a good message to send to people.
Senator Thompson.
So you've probably dealt with this. What if you get a little red light like Representative Davis had and you adhesive it to your reflector?
Well,
hiding the reflector?
Well, I would say that Senator Monroe and other folks who ride would probably say you don't want to ever cover a reflector.
Yeah.
What you want to do is put it on someplace else.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I do is I have it in addition to my reflector because I figure a lot of times your batteries go out. And I don't, and it's facing to the rear, so I don't even know until I get home. I look down, and, oh, man, my batteries went out. So, presumably the people would find someplace else to stick it on. I said in my testimony, we sure wouldn't want people taking off their rear reflectors and thinking, and then putting lights on. We don't want to diminish safety. And I appreciate the intention of the law. The problem is that when you get into a nanny state, the law is not enforced by a nanny. The law is enforced in a court of law against some kid whose parents thought that they had their child's bike outfitted when they bought it from Fred Meyer legally. And when they get hit and run down by a car, they find out when they go to court to get the medical bills that the child was riding illegally.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this bill? Seeing none, we will close public hearing on that one. And let's see here. Get rid of that. And we'll open a public hearing on 2938. Is that the right one?
Yep.
See that?
Mr. Chair, Committee Members, House Bill 2938 prohibits city from requiring consent to annexation of landowner's property in exchange for city providing county service as agent of county. Declares emergency, effective on passage, no amendment. There is no revenue impact and has a minimal fiscal impact.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Clem, state representative from House District 21, which is here in Salem, where we're residing now. And this is one of a few somewhat broad relating clauses that I've sent over here that I'm here to try and talk about the current contents of this bill and not whatever else anybody else might want to do with it. So House Bill 2938 is something that I've been working on for a few sessions. It was an issue in a few cities around Oregon at one point. Doesn't seem to be as much of an issue anymore, but it has to do with when a county contracts with a city for some services because the county just doesn't find it economical or efficient to do that. So, for example, here in Marion County, at one time, we had a situation where Marion County, well, they still do this part, contracts for services with City of Salem to issue various building permits because it's just not that many of them, and why would the county keep a building permit office when they could contract with City of Salem? The challenge was you would have somebody who lived out in the county who's not on any city water or septic systems or sewer systems, anything like that. They're clearly county residents, not under a non-remonstrance agreement for annexation or anything like that, and they wanted to remodel their bathroom or remodel a shop out back. We had a situation where they would be sent down to the city to get the building permit because Marion County didn't maintain a building permit office. And at the time, the city was taking the opportunity to force the people to sign a non-remonstrance agreements consenting to eventual annexation in order to get their county building permit for remodeling a bathroom. Now, if it had been to connect to a city service, I wouldn't have any objection. And you've probably heard those kind of debates in certain cities. I think Lincoln City has a debate about their water system and people hooking into it. That's not what this is about. The bill is about, as it says very specifically, a city may not require consent to annexation of a landowner's property in exchange for the city providing a county service as an agent of the county. So Salem hasn't been doing it for several years now, but every now and then we'll get somebody who calls us and says, and I think some gentlemen here can tell you about them, my city tried to get me to sign one of these non-remonstrance agreements, and all I was trying to do was get, you know, my building permit. That's what this is aimed at. It is currently already, we believe, according to an LC opinion dating way back, illegal to do this. Doesn't mean it hasn't been attempted. When we find the people who've attempted, who've been on the bad end of it, we furnished them the LC letter, and usually their city backs off once seeing the LC opinion. But that's not the most efficient way to deal with this versus just put it right in the statute that you cannot do this. So anyway, that's the basic the bill. I won't tell you the whole story, but we had a witness last session come in and describe this whole ordeal where, again, out in the county, trying to put up a shop, had to sign the non-remonstrance agreement, then had to pay for the costs of the election to annex him because we have voter approvals here. So he had to pay for the cost of the own election to annex him against his will, all to put up a shop so he could hire some new employees out in Marion County. And that was, in his case, I think, $7,000 for the permit and another several thousand dollars for the election that he didn't want to have and didn't want to be part of. And I didn't bother bringing him down today, but he would have been a good horror story to show you what we're aiming at here. And the cities and I have talked about this for several sessions. Usually they foil me somewhere in the process. Sometimes I've even killed my own bill because they convinced me I'd written it so poorly that it was going to have the reverse effect, so I've withdrawn it. This time I let the gentleman from the Community Voices in Annexation write it, and it's a lot more simple. You can judge for yourself whether I've hit the target after Erin does her good work on my bill, as usual. But this is an attempt to try and get this one to the finish line.
Or I pulled the wrong bill.
Questions are Senator Riley?
Yeah. Hi, good to see you. What you said earlier was if this were about hooking up to the water or sewer or something, you wouldn't have a problem. But isn't this bill broad enough that it covers that as well?
So would I don't think so, because in exchange for the city providing a county service, so the county would have to have water and sewer lines, and then the city were providing it on behalf of the county. And I don't know of any counties that have water and sewer lines that are the city providing the service on behalf of the county.
follow up?
Mm-hmm, please.
But one of the things that I've heard about, and I may have heard wrong, so you can correct me if I have, is that there are instances right now where this would allow the city to provide water for the airport. Mm-hmm. And under this bill, am I hearing this wrong?
That a city could provide it to the airport?
Yeah, because it's out in the county, it's not in the city, and so
this is all, Senator Riley. This is about whether or not you can have them sign a non-remonstrance agreement,
yes.
Which means you voluntarily consent to annexation.
Right.
And it wouldn't do anything to either allow or disallow services. It's if the city were going to be providing services as an agent of the county, can they make them sign something or not? And in the case of, actually, we had this conversation yesterday about the airport bill. I think if a city were going to extend it voluntarily, if a city were going to extend its services out to an airport, they should be able to say, at the time that our city eventually grows out to you, then you can't fight us on annexation, because that's their infrastructure cost and their property, and they should have contractual rights to obligate. If you want to hook onto my property, I can give whatever conditions I want to. And I think that's appropriate. But I don't think this bill would touch that issue, because
okay.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Senator Thompson?
Yeah. Rep Klim, good to see you. Happy Valley is in one of my cities, and they just had some concern. And I don't know if they were they there on the House side.
No, I don't think any cities came, just the League of Cities, but no specific cities came, so I don't know what theirs are exactly.
Okay. And I can either ask you, they're not real tough questions, or I could do it afterwards and just ask if you could make a phone call with them, and some of their questions were hard or soft services. They had some questions about that and weren't sure that they differentiated, like Senator Riley mentioned. Also, another one was in the bill, they said there's no real definition of agent of the county. What it means by when you say agent of the county. And in some cases, they say Happy Valley is a service provider by proxy. And how would you handle that case? So I can get
together with you on these later. Let me research them.
Yeah. And there are no questions that I think that they had that can't be answered. And it's not like they're against the bill. They just had some questions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, I can tell you one time I tried the other way, which was listing every single service and which could or couldn't. That was the time where I finally just suicided my own bill, because I had gotten so far. I just confused myself by the time I was done, and I wasn't sure I wasn't giving cities new powers to annex.
Okay.
And Aaron was becoming less opposed to it, so then I got nervous, and then I just killed the whole thing. So,
all right.
I don't know that this is exactly perfect, and maybe their questions could help inform that discussion.
I just got this today, so I'll get together with you. Thanks.
More? Anybody else? So, Representative, I guess I have one. The Is this primarily targeted at areas where the city, and I think you use Marion County and Salem, where Salem, within their urban growth boundary, may say to somebody, we have a policy of we won't give you a building permit unless you annex? Is that what this is about?
I think it's both outside the UGB and inside the UGB. The ones I encountered personally were inside the UGB, because my district is only inside the UGB, and it was the first time it happened. I was going door to door, and I met a lady who was telling me the story, and she showed me her shop, and that she had to go down and get a permit. That was in the UGB, and I think it is because they had a policy that if it's inside the UGB, you should be annexed. So therefore, let's take whatever opportunity we can to get you to sign one of these. Now, they backed off because, as I said, LC has said that's not lawful. Just being in the UGB is not an inherent way you can force someone to sign a non-remonstrance agreement. Using a city service is. Like, if we don't do this here, but if you wanted to say no library card unless you sign a non-remonstrance agreement and pay $50. I think you could do that because the city's the one that paid for the library.
So under this, could they require, I'm just probing this a little bit, in that example, could they say you're inside the UGB, services are available, we will not give you a building permit unless you hook up to services?
Under the bill? Under the bill, no, because they're, well, under current law, they can't force you to hook up to services unless you have a public health or safety type exemption where DEQ has ordered an emergency annexation for those purposes. So they don't have the authority to force someone to do it except under that limited circumstance. But if somebody came in and said, I want to get a another service from the county other than those services, we're trying to prevent them forcing them to hook up to, well, I wouldn't say hook up to services. We're trying to force to prevent them from forcing them to become part of the city against their will when they're not using any city services. They're only using services contracted by the county.
Other questions? I see none. Thank you, Representative. Appreciate you bringing this to Bill.
Thank you.
And I am going to go back and finish up this top of the order, and we'll come back to this. So we'll recess on this momentarily, just momentarily, and we will reopen on House Bill 3401A, and we are at Hal and John Knoxville. Back to Amtrak. Not Amtrak. Trains.
What is Amtrak?
Amtrak is part of it, but it's trains. Yeah.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Hal Gard. I'm the administrator of ODOT's Rail and Public Transit Division. I provided written testimony, but I just wanted to add a few clarifying comments. Passenger rail and freight, of course, in the state of Oregon are absolutely linked. It requires strong partnerships with both the railroads, Amtrak, state of Washington, state of Oregon, in order to be able to run the service effectively and efficiently. We've been actively working with our partners to maximize operation within the corridor. And House Bill 3401-A would give us a clear statutory direction to examine potential changes to both improve on-time performance and to increase the ridership on our trains. The bill directs us to explore modern dispatch systems, to identify potential infrastructure improvements within the corridor. The bill also directs us to explore ways to improve the ridership, the ticket revenue, including creating a marketing strategy that explores ways to boost tourism through the use of passenger rail. House Bill 3401A supports the effort ODOT's undertaken to seek a $10.4 million general fund request to continue to be able to fund the Amtrak's Cascade service. And through the general fund request, we'd be able to continue marketing the service with the goal of increasing ridership on the trains. We see the work efforts required by the bill as a pathway to make the corridor more efficient, and we'd look forward to continuing to work with our partners on recommendations for improvements.
Great. So, obviously, in support. Yes, sir.
Okay, good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is John Knoxall, 1500 Narkenzie Road, Eugene. And as a citizen and passenger rail advocate, I'm here also to testify in support of House Bill 3401A. I wish I could have taken the train here today from Eugene. My work schedule and existing frequencies don't allow that, but even if they did, I'd probably need to allow a cushion of about an hour to be reasonably sure I could be here on time to testify. For the same reason, I would need an hour cushion if I were driving to Portland for something in the late afternoon. Congestion. Congestion on the tracks, congestion on the freeways. On-time performance is one of the biggest obstacles to increasing ridership on Cascade's trains, which is why I am supportive of this bill. In the past decade, there's been much talk and excitement about high-speed rail, but not as much attention to the incremental, though less technologically sexy and less politically sexy, steps to higher-speed rail. And there's been even less attention to the goal of reliable rail service, yet that was repeatedly cited by participants in ODOT open houses in recent years on improving Oregon passenger rail service, and Representative Nathanson alluded to that in her comments a while ago. A lot of attention has been on California's HSR program nationally, but again, that's building on decades of incremental investment in more reliable, higher-speed rail, and that's been done in meeting the freight rail needs of the same Union Pacific Railroad that now hosts Oregon's Cascades. by redirecting focus on improving mobility and reliability for both freight and passenger rail, this measure is a big step to boosting that on-time performance and therefore ridership. Similar studies were already in place in Washington in 2009 when stimulus money became available, but since Oregon didn't have that study in place, so much of that money bypassed us. This incremental approach also promises a more efficient approach to increasing capacity and reliability, such as identification of new sidings and signaling, updating recommendations from a 1990 study that would have exponentially increased capacity far less than the cost of one freeway interchange, as well as providing for marketing, which has decreased significantly in recent years. Oregon has made a good start in station renovations and Cascades equipment, but we are overdue for getting past the starting gate and growing service. House Bill 3401A provides an overdue look at infrastructure improvements that will help exponentially grow that service. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, each gentleman? Senator Rod.
Yeah, this one's for Hal and ODOT. I'm trying to figure out why we need to have a bill that asks for the fact that they want the railroad to be run efficiently from ODOT. I mean, I don't understand that. So can you enlighten me why we have to have this bill to ask for the railroad to be run efficiently?
Just for clarity's sake, the department is neutral on the bill, although we do see that there are some advantages to a short-term study and a focus study on specific steps we can take, such as the marketing studies, the schedule studies, to make sure that we didn't get it right when we changed our schedules last year. And in best analysis that we had from Amtrak did not pan out. So we would like to actually take the focus look to make sure that when we do a schedule change, to try to increase our ridership and recover what we had, that it's the right change. Does that answer the question?
It still seems to me like, the question is, or the observation is, it's not being run efficiently, and I'm just trying to figure out why you need a study to figure out that it's not being run efficiently and what you could do better if you are the oversight. But that's just, go ahead, right here.
Did you want to reply?
I thought I had.
You don't.
Thank you,
okay.
Chair Byron.
Senator Riley. So I wanted to follow up on what Senator Girard said, which is, do you need a bill to perform a study? Why can't you go ahead and do it?
Chair Byer, Senator Riley, we will do the work. If this bill passes or not, we will continue to do that work. We will do the study.
Oh, thank you.
I suspect that the Representative Nathansons wanted to make sure that the study was done.
And passing the bill
and hadn't been done, in her opinion, today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's probably it. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, and in the Ways and Means sub, we heard the same pledge. We heard the same testimony that, in fact, the scheduling that they had changed wasn't working, was leading to less ridership, not more, and they were going to change it. So I believe this will happen whether we pass this bill or not.
Yeah.
But passing it won't stop it from happening.
It absolutely won't.
That's true.
Anything else? Gentlemen?
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Well, we'll close the public hearing on that, and we will just put a nail in it and see if it works. The chair moves House Bill 3401A to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. And is there a discussion on that? Is there any opposition?
I'm a no.
One no?
I'm okay.
Okay. House Bill 3401A passes to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation, and the chair will carry it. So we'll close on that. And we're done with that one. Now we'll get back to, and we will reopen on House Bill 2938. And let's see. Mr. Ritter, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to clarify for the record that the Honorable address on my testimony applies to all of you. You seem to be interested in that today. I'm Jerry Ritter, representing Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexation. We are the ones who wrote this bill. We were formed in 1996 by leaders of citizens groups in five Oregon communities who had given themselves the right to have a stronger voice in annexation decisions via the initiative process. And subsequently, more than a couple dozen other communities sought our input as they went down the same road. And today, OCVA is a coalition of citizens groups in 33 communities around the state who have taken these same measures. We also led the successful effort to amend ORS 195, ORS 22750, for which we had strong legislative support. And we constantly have to defend those things that we did against those who would take away the rights for the citizens. We submitted the language for 2938 for two reasons. First and foremost is the fairness issue, which Representative Clem addressed. And I can tell you that this is going on in cities around the state. Eugene's been doing it for many years. Springfield, not as much. Beaverton has done it. So it is still an issue that's going on. So I would just ask you to put yourself in the place of that UGB homeowner who wants to, say, upgrade his or her bathroom, wants to maybe turn part of his or her garage into a spare bedroom. The county has delegated to the city under an IGA or some other proxy agreement the task of supplying building permits and inspections. So you go down to the city, you apply for the permit, you pay the fee, and then you're told you have to sign a consent to annexation agreement, subject yourself to a potential doubling of your property taxes, tens of thousands of dollars in fees and assessments, just for the privilege of getting that permit. We have never seen or heard of a legitimate, credible reason for that demand, and we think it's got to go. The second reason is legal in nature, and Representative Clem also described the Legislative Council opinion that was issued in January 2007, and it says, and I quote, "A city may require consent to annexation only for delivering its own services, not for acting as an agent of a county." Now, that word apparently hasn't gotten out to cities because it is going on. Cities will point out that this bill could interfere with some provisions in an IGA, a comp plan, or other proxy agreement that allows the practice. And yes, that's true. That's the intent of the bill, to supersede any of those agreements. If the cities are given a way around the prohibition through some local agreement, the bill becomes meaningless. And Representative Clem referred to that indirectly because that's what killed previous efforts on this bill. If you have enough loopholes in it, it doesn't really mean anything. 2938 would not prohibit a city from requiring consent to annexation for provision of a city service, for example, sewers, water. That bill does not address this. The airport bill is a separate issue, and I think Representative Clem addressed that, hopefully. I'll point out, submit to you, that House Bill 2938 received a unanimous committee endorsement in the House, a 59-1 House vote, and I would submit that that speaks to the merits of the bill. I would ask that you join us and your House colleagues in sending this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll be happy to try to address any questions you may have.
Thank you. Senator Gerard?
There's been some question with the definition, an agent of. Would you like to take on the record what that means? Or
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, an agent of the county to us means that the county has delegated to the city the task of supplying or providing certain services. Most common example is building permits, building inspections. If you live in the county is your governing body. The county or special districts provide your service. For example, the county provides certain services for me. I'm with a special district, the Rainbow Water District, where I served on the board. These are not city services. They're provided extraterritorially by the city as an agent of the county. So the county has delegated to the city those tasks. But the county is, as LC defines it, the appropriate service provider. They have just delegated that task. And again, I will echo Representative Clem's statements that we don't have an issue. If the city wants to extend a city service under ORS 222115, they can require annexation for that. We're not trying to deny them that. Now, cities will also argue that they have to be able to do this because somehow UGB residents are not paying their fair share. They're getting subsidized. We've heard that argument for 20 years. We've seen no facts and data to back it up ever. What facts and data we have seen are contained in this service incident study that was done in Washington County back in 2007. They found no evidence of that claim. In fact, they found something very different. I can provide this to your staff. I'd be happy to do that. And I'll echo the words of former State Senator Charlie Ringo, who made the comment that cities simply have not made their case for that argument.
I've heard enough. Thank you.
You okay? Okay. Anything else? Seeing none. Thank you very much,
Chair and committee members.
Let's see. Dennis Egner? Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer and honorable committee members, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on this. I am the planning director with the City of Milwaukee, and I might point out, Senator Thompson, that there is a letter in your packet. Yeah, it's actually signed both by the mayor of Milwaukee and the mayor of Happy Valley in opposition to the bill. I personally have over 35 years of experience as a planner in Oregon, and have worked for five different cities. So
Sir. Could we put your name on the record, please?
Yeah, my name is Dennis Egner, E-G-N-E-R. Yeah, and have over 35 years of experience in Oregon working as a planner. So I've seen annexation and urban growth issues in a number of different environments. I'm here today partially because we were unaware that this was an issue at the House. It slipped through the House without it being on our radar at all. I know that's not an excuse, but you know, we might have been able to change the opinion of some House members had we had an opportunity to speak with them in advance of the vote. So we are in opposition of House Bill 2938. View it really as an anti-city bill in a lot of ways. It interferes with the ability of cities to carry out their comprehensive plans and their intergovernmental agreements with counties to basically implement statewide planning goal 14. That's the urban growth management goal. Milwaukee, our comprehensive plan in Milwaukee, and Happy Valley has a similar language, it calls for the cities to be the ultimate providers of urban services in their urban service areas. Those areas are outlined in intergovernmental agreements, urban growth management agreements with the county. We have in Milwaukee about 1,500 acres between the city limits and I-205 that are in our urban service area. Most of that area is developed today to some level or another, and it's served by water by special districts, and it's served by sewer by a county service district that is administered by Clackamas County. In Washington County, there's a similar sewer provider, Clean Water Services. So the counties are very much involved in this process. But our concern about those services being provided, we don't have the same services that, say, a McMinnville, a Newburgh, other communities that provide water and sewer to their urban service have. They're provided by other jurisdictions. So it's very difficult for us to trigger annexation at the perimeter of the city. We have begun a process of renegotiating our urban growth management agreement with Clackamas County, and this bill basically will take away some of the tools that we think are important to include in that renegotiation, and that being essentially planning services, the types of services that are provided when land divides, when subdivisions occur, when partitions occur, when new streets are put in, and for other similar larger scale developments. If the objective of this bill is to prohibit cities from requiring annexation for a bathroom addition, it should say that. It's not. It doesn't say that. It is very broadly written to pick up any service that might be contracted with the county. Those planning services, land divisions, subdivisions, service—you know—the types of services that have an impact on the city, have an impact on the city street system, have an impact on the locations where we connect with those unincorporated areas. So, with that, I will stop. I'll be happy to answer any questions. I would just urge you to recommend a no vote on this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Drott?
Yeah, I'm just trying to get your philosophy down here. These are people that live in the county, and normally the county would provide the service, but because they contracted with the city, you think you have a right to have them consent to annexation? That seems to be the crux of what you're saying. I'm just having a hard time seeing that philosophy. If the county had the service, you wouldn't be in that position.
It's partly the philosophy of the Oregon land use system that cities are the ultimate providers of urban services. Yeah. And that philosophy is essentially written into every urban growth management agreement around the state. And we have in this area, there's a lot of development that occurred prior to our agreements in place. Those properties needed sewer service. The county provided that sewer service. We now are in a position where we have no ability to provide higher levels of urban services to that area, especially some of those properties that are underdeveloped. We have a number of these properties in this area don't have our developable properties. And those are the properties that I am most concerned about. I am not concerned about the building permit for the addition. I'm not concerned about the vacant lot that needs a house on it. I'm concerned about the developable property.
One follow-up. Don't you have a right to annex without consent?
You would have a right to request annexation, but these properties, because they have water and sewer service already available, won't. They can go to the county and get their permits. They can go to the county and get their land divisions. And what we want to work on with the county is to renegotiate our agreement so those types of decisions have to be made by the city, because there are impacts on our street system when they do develop. So those are the types of things that are important to us in this bill, and we're afraid this bill is just too broad.
One final. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to pick on you here, but it seems like it's a question of dollars. The city wants to annex so that they can get more dollars because the people that are living in the county are paying to the county, and they're paying a lower rate of tax than if they were in the city. If they have sewer and water that's furnished by the county, what is the city providing to get those additional dollars?
The services that we provide at a higher level, again, are generally police services, planning services, the fire protection is also a district. There's the parks are also a district. We own park land, provide the park land, the park district administers it. We're handcuffed on a lot of the types of services that you might see provided by other independent cities throughout the region. And this bill puts further barriers in place.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see here. Aaron Doyle. Steve, you want to come up as well? The other two we've got. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. And Representative Clem is correct that we have gone back and forth on this issue for a number of years, and it's a very difficult question, and I don't envy the decision that you have to make, but there are significant concerns with the way this bill is drafted. And first, this goes to Senator Rod's question of who is an agent. And I think that only lawyers can answer that question, and they tend to only answer it when we're facing litigation. Because agency is a legal concept and it's a legal construct, and I do believe that it is when there is a contract in place whereby we're providing those services that are often provided by a county, that is when we become an agent. But if you look back at the LC opinion from 2007, it's only discussing the issue of where the building permit authority is provided for in an urban intergovernmental agreement. It doesn't account for the situation in which a number of our cities and counties have reached two types of agreements. One is that the city will be providing those building permit services, usually in the UGB, because it's just easier when you're that close in to just go to one place. But the second agreement that's often in place is what Mr. Engers referred to as the Urban Growth Management Agreement. And I've been trying to do the research, but it's very difficult because the internet's only so good. I can only Google so well. but if you look at a number of the counties across the state on a one-on-one basis, they've reached urban growth management agreements with the cities. Some include a requirement that any building permits that are granted in the urban growth boundary must be accompanied by an agreement to annex. So where a city, pursuant to an intergovernmental agreement, is providing the building permit services, and a member, a resident of the UGB, yes, a resident of the county, comes to the city counter and says, I need a building permit because I want to, you know, urbanize, further develop my property, or maybe simply to do a bathroom remodel. The city looks at their stuff and says, oh, well, we have the secondary agreement, and the county would also require this consent to annexation as pursuant to the urban growth management agreement that's been reached. And the purpose of these urban growth management agreements is to execute the goals that were provided through the statewide land use planning system. Goal 14 in particular, which calls for the orderly urbanization of the UGB and then annexation into the city so that urban areas remain inside the cities and less urban areas remain out in the county lands. So it becomes very complicated, because one of the things that happened when Senate Bill 100 was enacted and annexation statutes have been developed, there has never been a requirement for cohesion between those two concepts. And so we struggle with our UGBs. We struggle to account for growth and development and increased capacity within smaller amounts of land. I can rail on the statewide land use system if you'd like me to, but I'll not digress that far. But we then run into, okay, now we have this UGB planned and development's supposed to take place inside this UGB, and we have to increase density in these areas, and we're supposed to annex these folks in, and we run into a set of annexation statutes that don't align with that principle. Many of our cities have run into a lot of different issues when it comes to annexation, some so significant that there are special carve-outs within legislation about who can be annexed when or if at all, to the point where many of our cities have taken on the position that annexation will only occur with consent of the resident, because it's just not worth the attempt to annex anymore. What that does is sufficiently stall our UGB process. It sufficiently stalls development, because you can't ask for more developable land until you've shown that you're using the stuff that you have. If we are not in control of that level of development, we can't guarantee that we're developing to the level that's necessary. So what this bill does is continues that separation between annexation and the statewide land use planning system, and I think that's very dangerous. What I do think is necessary is a very comprehensive look at how annexation and land use processes need to go together. This issue came up in 2013 when a different committee, the Rural Communities Committee, which no longer is around, had a conversation, and we kind of did an annexation 101 in June 2013. It's all in OLIS if you want to look back and see that hearing. But I think the conclusion of all of us that presented testimony at that point is that there needs to be a reexamination of how annexation policy and urban growth policy work together in this state. And I think that the League would be very supportive of looking at how that works. Or how that actually doesn't work and how that's impacting not just the annexation conversation, but the urban growth conversation. The issue in Tigard that was referenced in the 2007 LC opinion has actually resolved locally. The city of Tigard now doesn't try to do this. I think that they would agree that they exceeded their authorities because they did not have an urban growth management agreement with the county at the time. And that's the difference. Eugene has been brought up often. I have asked them repeatedly to do the analysis, and they say that they don't believe that their practices will be impacted by this bill. In past sessions, I've heard that they have this urban growth management agreement, and that's the purpose of the urban growth management agreement with Lane County, is to ensure that the development of property, particularly when it comes to partitioning and subdivision, that's urbanization, density building, that's going to occur with annexation and only with annexation, because the county can't continue to be responsible for trying to urbanize areas. In Clackamas County in particular, if you look around the metro region, the greater picture, there is a lot of unincorporated residential and urbanization areas, and that interferes with the city's ability to grow and develop in an orderly fashion, because once you've got everything, you look like a city but aren't a city, there's no incentive to join a city. And while I understand that this is in part about who's paying what taxes, I think that there is more to a city than a property tax base. I think that there's a sense of community, a sense of direct leadership. Our local governments are directly responsive to the constituents they represent, and that is an important piece of what the annexation process is about extending that identity to those that are out there. And to Senator Riley's question, I know that, for example, the city of Cornelius in Washington County is serviced in part by the Clean Water Services Agency, and they are very concerned that this will impact their ability to direct and control who's hooking up to the sewers and the ramifications to annexation for that. I can't answer their question. I'm not their attorney, so I've asked them to have their certified legal experts determine what the agency direction is and the issues that will arise for them under that. My concern is that in the end, by undoing these urban management agreements, this bill is going to be looking into a contract renegotiation for every city that has one of these agreements, and might be interfering with the ability for the cities and counties to cooperatively work to meet the Goal 14 requirements. And for those reasons, we just oppose this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We're the land use planners and citizen planning board representatives around the state. Our membership comprises people from both sides, people who are developers, representing developers, and those who are on the other side of the counter who are working for cities or other local governments. So we are very cautious about the issues that we take a stand on, because we have different philosophies within our organization. We do take positions on bills where we think there are overreaching issues of generally supporting the Oregon land use planning process. And where we think we have a situation like this is today, one person has a very narrow problem. They go to their legislator and say, can you fix this? And the legislator drafts a broad bill. As you heard, it's a tough issue to resolve by drafting a bill, and Representative Clem tried a number of times unsuccessfully to get what he wanted. Because you're trying to resolve a very narrow issue with a sledgehammer, and that's essentially what this bill is doing. It interferes with the rights of cities and counties to enter into planning for urbanization under statewide planning goal 14. It may interfere with existing agreements, and I don't want to be redundant. I've got some written testimony that I've sent in, but I think you understand our problems with the bill. You just heard it said more in detail by Aaron. We oppose the bill. If there's a problem that's very specific and can be taken care of, then we would be happy to engage our members in some kind of process to look at how we can draft something that takes care of something narrow, rather than really getting at a problem that is statewide.
Thank you. Let's see. Senator Monroe?
Did either one of you testify against this bill on the House side? And if not, why not?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, I did testify, and I sent emails to many of the representatives, but a little too close to the floor vote, I think. But I did testify. I've always testified in opposition to the concepts that I think are too broad like this, so I was there.
Okay. You're very influential. It was 59-0. Steve?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I represent a group of volunteers, and there are an enormous number of land use bills that are introduced in this legislation. These folks who are trying to work full-time and keeping up with a list of 90 or 100 different bills sometimes slip up and don't catch everyone.
That's why there's a Senate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Girard?
Well, yes, I did ask the question about the definition of an agent of, but I'm trying to, I'm putting myself in Representative Clem's position, I'm trying to figure out how I would write the bill. And if you try to list every possible thing that could be subcontracted to the city, I mean, the list would be, and then it would really get very complex. And he says that's like stepping into quicksand, and I totally believe that. So I'm just trying to figure out how you think that it should be written so that it's I don't see where it's broadly written. It's a small problem, but I don't see where it's that broadly written. So tell me what the problem is with an agent of.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, I think the issue is where the agency is backed up so that there's a secondary agreement by which, even within working as the agent of the county, you're also supporting the county's policies to require the consent to annex. So that's the issue. So it's not when we're solely acting as the county agent and have no further legal boundaries by which we're restricted on how we operate, but where there's an Urban Growth Management Act, if we are acting as the county's agent in providing the building permit, we might not be able to abide by that Urban Growth Management Act. And that's just the one example that has jumped to the forefront, and you can never write legislation that catches all of the nuance, but I think that that's the breadth.
Okay, I understand the problem that would be where you have intergovernment agreements. So if we did an exclusion where intergovernment agreements, would that rectify the problem or not?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, that's what I've when we were working on the legislation in 2013, that was one of the pieces that I had placed into the puzzle. I do believe that OCVA is opposed to that addition of the amendment.
I got some people shaking their head back there.
The claim that will just become a loophole by which all cities will act poorly through. I don't think we tend to act poorly, but that's my position. But that I think that if you did put in the exception where you're also acting pursuant to another intergovernmental agreement would be sufficient to rectify the situation.
More?
No, I'm good.
Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill, one of the things that was said earlier on by someone else is that these things happen inside and outside the UGB. And for me, if the bill said that this only applied outside the UGB, I would probably be okay with it. But with it being occurring inside the UGB, I can see why the cities would be opposed to this. They have a requirement, as they say, under land use Rule 14, that Goal 14 to urbanize out to the UGB, and I think that's a key for me.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Don't see any. Last chance. Okay, we'll close the public hearing, and I think we will let this one set for a day, give people a chance to think about it. I believe that takes us to the end of the agenda. Have I missed anything, James?
Good to go.
We're good to go? Okay, so we are done for the day.